So yes, what we're doing in this series on Dharma Night is exploring symbols from Tantric Buddhism, what we call Tantric Buddhism, and you could call that a phase of Buddhism, or it is a historical phase, but also you could just as well call it a sort of aspect or approach to the Dharma. And another term for Tantric Buddhism is the Vajrayana, or the diamond way of Buddhism. And in the Vajrayana or Tantric Buddhism, there's a particular emphasis placed on symbols and ritual and meditation. So what this phase of Buddhism was emphasising, or in a way sort of sprang into being as a corrective for, was the sort of danger of overemphasizing concepts. So Tantric Buddhism, or the Vajrayana, is addressing itself to direct experience, kind of unmediated through concepts and words. So that's why there's this emphasis on symbols. And we're using this book, Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism, from a series of lectures by Sangharaja, given way back ages ago, these lectures. I think it'd be in the 80s, maybe. I've talked to a couple of people who were at these lectures, and they just said it was so exciting listening to them that they felt like they'd entered another world. And the people, one person I talked to said she used to drive home afterwards and she always got lost because she kind of didn't know where she was anymore after hearing these lectures. You can also listen to them on Free Buddhist Audio. And then they've been put together in this book that we're kind of drawing from each week. So we've said, in a way, in the last few weeks, we've talked about what a symbol is and what it isn't. But as well as that, just to emphasise that symbols aren't just something out there, that symbols, if it really is a symbol, then it will act on us as well. It will work on us and transform us if we are receptive to it or to them. And what Sangharakshita says, he says that symbols stand for something of which we're not yet conscious, but of which we can become conscious and which we can come to know in a dharmic sense. Yeah? And he again emphasises that they're not something dead and inert. They're full of energy and they give life to something in us. It's like they spark something off in us. And that can happen over time. Like one single symbol, as it were, can spark more and more off in us over time. If we really engage in it with it, that more can come to light, as it were, over time. So he's emphasising that, that by their nature they're creative. So the creative symbols of Tantric Buddhism, we're not just learning about them for some sort of historical interest. That they actually, why we're trying to engage with them, so they can energise us and spark off developments in our own Dharma life. So that's just a little bit of introduction to why we're exploring these symbols. And as you have seen by now, we're exploring this symbol on the shrine. Does anyone know? I'm sure some of you do know the name of the figure that this is. What do we see on the shrine? Who do we see on the shrine?
I know the name, but I don't know much about her. I've read something.
Sometimes this figure is called Vajrayogini. There's a more generic name for this figure. Dakini. Yeah, Dakini. Mm-hmm. Of which Vajrayogini is a Dakini. So, Dakini. And Dakini, apparently, the word is derived from a Sanskrit root that means space or direction or sky. And when the tantric texts were translated into Tibetan, the tantra as a form of Buddhism particularly exists in Tibet. So when the tantric texts were translated into Tibetan, Dakini was rendered a sky walker. Yeah, so you've got, so this figure is a Dakini, a sky walker. So I just want to say a bit about this space aspect. So, well, space represents to us empty space. It represents a free from obstruction, doesn't it? Freedom of movement. So the Dakini represents complete freedom of movement. And space, and when we're talking about space here, we're talking about it in a particular way. So it's not literal space, that's something that we see out there. So the word for space, does anyone know what the word for space is in Buddhism? I know some of you do. You do? Akasha. We're smiling because this is Akasha and Mitra sitting here. So the word is Akasha. And what Bhante Sankaracharya says about Akasha, I really like this. He says it's not so much the space that you see out there, it's the space that you, when you close your eyes, it's that inner space when you close your eyes and experience, yeah? So it's that experience of space. So Akasha, or space, or sky, it represents mind itself in a particular way, not our ordinary mind full of chatter and so on, but this, what you might, a bit reluctant to use this term, absolute mind, but I can't think of a better one, something, the sort of mind in its fullest sense, so not just my mind or your mind, but mind itself, free from obstruction, like the blue sky, yeah, so the Dakini represents free-flowing movement of the mind itself. And what Bhante says, he says, it's the thrills or tremors of emotional energy that pass quivering through the mind, bubbling up from its very depths. So the thrills or tremors of emotional energy that pass quivering through the mind, bubbling up from its very depths. So you've got like a complete relationship between the Dakini and this sense of Akasha or space. And interesting enough, I was just chatting, can I tell you a little story, Jnanabhaja, I was just talking to Jnanabhaja before the class, and he said, oh yes, I used to dream of Dakinis, but then he said, oh, but they didn't, when he dreamt of them, they didn't look like this, like this figure on the street, they looked like ordinary women. But then sooner or later in the dream, he would discover that their name began with the word Akasha, and that was the clue. That was how he knew they were Dakinis. So you've got this, yeah, the Dakini is a skywalker, but it's sky or space in the particular sense of Akasha. Okay, so I thought we'd just spend a good bit of time now exploring this figure. So this isn't a traditional image. This is a sort of modern painting. You can see more traditional Tibetan forms. You might have seen them in various books and so on. So this is a modern day painting that someone painted for me. But it's got most of the main elements of the Dakini in it. It's got a couple missing, but I can describe them. So I just thought we would just explore them, just explore what you see and what sort of speaks to you about this figure. So we'll start off with that. So what do you notice about this figure? What do you notice first of all? Maybe do sit so you can see.
She's dancing.
She's dancing, yeah.
Drinking blood.
She's drinking, yeah, what looks like blood. We'll come back to explore both these things, the drinking blood and the dancing.
She's naked.
She's naked, she certainly is.
She's red.
She's red, yes, yes. She's red.
She's in a circle?
Hmm?
She's in a circle.
She's encircled, yes. Yes, tradition, she's encircled with flames.
She's fearless.
She's?
Fearless.
Fearless, well...
Or looks like.
She looks like she's fearless. Okay, well, that's a very important aspect, yeah. And it's interesting to tell that by her look.
She's got yellow hair.
She's got yellow hair. I think it might be grey hair, actually. But yes. yeah. yeah. And we'll come back to the hair as well. There's one even kind of more obvious thing. Maybe it's almost so obvious it's easy to overlook. Maybe I'll just
it's
say.
A woman?
Hmm?
It's a woman?
Yeah. She's a she, yes. yeah, she's a she. So, brilliant. So I'm going to go through some of these things, and I'm going to mostly be telling you what Sangharakshita draws. Like Sangharakshita, for those of you who don't know, is the founder of our movement, and our teacher and author of many books and talks. So, yes, I'm going to talk, first of all, I'm going to say what he says about her red. Well, maybe I'll ask you first before I say, so let's go into this fact she's red. So what's red, the colour? What does red as a symbol symbolise?
Energy.
Energy,
fiery.
Yeah. Fieriness.
Intensity.
Intensity, yeah.
Anger,
yeah.
Passion. Love.
Hmm?
Love.
Blunt, yeah.
Love.
Oh, love and blood, yes. yeah.
Danger.
Danger, yeah.
It can be earthiness as well.
Okay. Ah, like the red clay of the earth.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah. That's interesting, isn't it, as well as the sky. So, yeah, so all these are included. I'll just tell you what Sangharakshita says. So he puts this first, this is her most striking thing, she's red in colour. So in Tantric Buddhism, but not just in Tantric Buddhism, I mean, it's quite universal, I think, to think that red is the colour of love, of passion, and emotional arousal. And in the case of the Dakini, this is total because she's completely red. She's not just kind of blushing red on her face, but she's completely red. Her whole body blushes, as it were. So the Dakini, what she represents in terms of the Dharma life, is a state of total emotional involvement in the Dharma life. And that's also why her hair is disheveled. Sometimes she's got black hair. I quite like that this one's got grey hair. But whatever colour her hair is, it's not all kind of combed and neat. It's, well, what does that what does that say to you, a sort of disheveled, even grey hair?
Freedom and passion.
So it ties in with the passion, yeah?
And freedom.
And why does it mean freedom to you?
Because it's like letting her whole self go. She's naked and her hair is... She just doesn't care.
It doesn't care, yeah. I think that's it.
It'd be wild.
And it's wild. And it's wild in a particular sort of not caring. It's not caring what people think, yeah. It's not kind of trying to... It's unconformed. It's not conforming to a sort of image of beauty in its kind of conventional form. Yeah, it's unconforming. It's abandonment, yeah. So it's abandonment. And sometimes apparently it's said that the Dakini throws herself into the Dharma life just as a passionate woman or person throws themselves into the arms of their lover. Yeah, so it's that kind of self-abandonment. She represents self-abandonment to the Dharma, to the three jewels. And Sangharaksha, he thinks this is really important. So here's what he says, and you can say whether you agree with it or not. So he says that usually people, i.e. us, find it difficult to give ourselves in this way, not just to the spiritual life, to the Dharma life, but to anything. He says that people find it difficult to plunge in and commit, find it difficult to plunge in, commit ourselves, get totally involved and put all our emotions into what we're doing. So, you're allowed to disagree if you want, but what do you think? Do you think that's true? Do you think we do? Do we give ourselves to our Dharma life? Do we throw ourselves into the arms of a lover? Do we even commit? You know, do we even fully do that? Yeah. What do you think?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. And it's okay. So sometimes.
For a short time.
For a short time. Uh huh. And when do you do that then?
When I'm very inspired.
Uh huh. Yeah. So when I'm really inspired. What happens the rest of the time?
Bits of me probably catch up or something, or aren't as inspired. I don't know. I'm not in the same conditions or something. I can't maintain that intensity or something.
Okay, so we can't maintain an intensity. Is that generally true of people?
I wouldn't say that. I would say I disagree strongly.
Uh-huh.
That would not throw me into something if I disagreed with it strongly.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And what about the things you do agree with?
Well, I probably would throw myself into those things.
Okay.
But
so
I do go from disagreeing very strongly to agreeing very strongly.
Okay, yeah. Well, in a way, that's... if one was able to throw oneself into things we agreed with, in a way, that's a rational reason for not throwing oneself in as we don't... is that we disagree. So that's a rational one. But I think also what Annie was getting at, that sometimes even... well, for some of us, that even when we do know and we do agree, we don't throw ourselves in. Is that true? Yeah?
Yes.
What stops you in that case?
Fear, we close up.
Fear, yeah.
We have fear, we have pain, things that hurt us and make us close up.
They make us close down, yeah. And Sham, did you have?
Just that even if you were... you could be really committed to something, but you might not be throwing yourself into it. It could be something that you're doing for the long haul, and so therefore you're kind of metering your.
Okay. So that again, that would be a more rational sort of. You'd have a measured response.
Sometimes we could be having certain commitments, but then there are these sort of underlying other reasons why we do certain things.
Okay.
And a commitment isn't quite purely just commitment itself.
Uh-huh.
And that could be an interference sometimes.
Okay, so something interferes. Would it be right to say what you're saying is we're not integrated enough, that we're not...
Say like somebody was really... into like their job, say for example, and it could be something that's about cooking.
Yeah.
Or it could be saying, oh, I'm really passionate about cooking, but then actually behind that there is this sort of needing to sort of reinforce a certain kind of a persona, thing about themselves, and if there's a change in that or like outside the circumstances, that could easily change.
I think that's a really good point, isn't it? Sometimes our commitment isn't tested. Sometimes when something's tested, we realise we weren't as committed as we thought we were.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's because we had mixed motives in the first place. And that's because we weren't integrated enough, which is quite, in a way, it's true probably of most of us most of the time. I'm not, this isn't said with any sort of moral blame or judgment. It's just a more, that can be how things are. Yeah.
For me, it's a fear of missing out.
Ah, yeah.
On what everybody else is doing.
Oh, yeah, that you'll make the wrong choice. Yeah, sort of a sitting on the fence.
Everybody's running that way, and here I'm going this way. I'm missing out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's also, yeah, I mean, disbelief. I think Dharma promises bliss, but I don't think I believe it.
Okay.
It's just the way that I don't see it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going this way.
Yeah, you want the result, you kind of where's the results then?
Yeah, so that's what it is. And I can see easily you can get pleasure this way. And
okay.
The bliss is not so easy to get, so.
Okay.
And there is disbelief.
Okay, yeah.
There's doubt, and doubt. And
yeah, so, yeah, so doubt stops us, yeah. And okay, so that's a good range, isn't it? So what, and what's, if we don't do that, if we don't plunge in and commit ourselves, not just to the Dharma, but to anything, what's the result of it? What's the consequence to us if we don't throw ourselves into the Dharma or anything?
So they're not really properly developed.
Yeah. Right. It's interesting, even your body language, would you say that? So we're not really properly developed.
Well, I mean, if you're going into trying anything, you know, if you're making a lasagna and you kind of have to do lasagna, you're going to get lasagna,
you don't get... that's quite good, yeah. So we never fully... It's interesting, when you say they're not really developed, I thought you were going to say, well, we're not really fully alive, actually. There's something that only... It's everything's by half measures, yeah? So there's a definite consequence to this. And I think, what Bhante says, and it ties in with this, lasagna, he says, if we won't achieve much in any direction, yeah, certainly not in a dharmic one, yeah? And interestingly enough, the first thing that Bhante talks about is, he says, we've got to actually get our emotions just flowing more freely, just generally, yeah? That often we can be quite afraid, we can be afraid of the strength of our emotions, we can be afraid to feel in the first place, yeah? This might not be true for everyone. But he's very concerned, Bhante. You come across this again and again in his writings, that we don't sort of dampen down and block our energies. And I think particularly he's concerned about this when we start to lead the Dharma life, because it's almost like we can almost use the fact that we're meant to be this spiritual person to start to squash ourselves down, because we think, oh well, a spiritual person wouldn't get angry, you know, or a spiritual person wouldn't da da da. So we use the very thing that we're trying to do against ourselves, yeah? So he's very, very concerned that we don't allow our energies to become blocked. At the same time, that doesn't mean that it's just a free-for-all and we just, vent our anger, for example, all over the place. I'll come back in a minute. He's not condoning that, but he's saying we've got to get in touch with our energies and sort of get to know them and know what they are and not allow them to become blocked, yeah? So you were going to...
I was going to say that if you don't throw yourself into something, then sometimes you realise your intention and that the throwing yourself into it might be... as well as less logical, it might be kind of willful in one direction, and if you step back you might see your intention. There might be some intention that you hadn't realised.
Okay, is that true in your experience?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Almost like a delayed version of mindfulness over like a longer period rather than just like as you act.
Okay, so by not acting, you realise you learn something?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. Well, that can be true. So it's interesting, isn't it, what what kind of leads for us, you know. Sometimes action leads and we discover our motivations by doing the thing, and sometimes not. So in a way, I think what this suggests is we have got to have our wits about us practicing the Dharma. If we threw ourselves into something that was very unskillful, that might not lead to positive results for us. So we have got to have mindfulness. At the same time, there's the other danger, which Bhante seems to be particularly warning us against just now, of not, almost sometimes even in the name of mindfulness, or in the name of being skillful, or in the name of being dharmic, holding ourselves back so much that we never, we sort of stultify ourselves. So you're going to have to, and that's an interesting path to tread. When is it wise to be mindful? Truly, well, it's always wise to be mindful in its true sense. It can never not be. But sometimes we might mistake mindfulness for something that Sangharaj has called elsewhere alienated awareness, where we think we're being mindful, but it's alienated from our emotions. So we're not doing anything wrong, strictly speaking, but neither are we fully alive. So I think that's what he's emphasising here in this lecture. I mean, elsewhere you'll find him obviously talking about mindfulness and so on. Yes.
Is that a form of repression?
Yeah, it would be. That's exactly what it would be. Maybe sort of repression or bypassing. It's a careful line to tread, because the answer isn't just to let everything be unrepressed, because then we would just be being unskillful and hurting ourselves and other people, and that wouldn't do us any good either. We've got to somehow be both mindful and unrepressed at the same time. So there's more of an art to it than might meet the eye. Yeah.
There are like several different layers, I think, of when to try to follow the Dharma and the awareness of what is there, or what is happening. And I think probably, at least in my experience, sometimes when I don't abandon myself, it's because there is a fear, precisely because I feel I am getting towards true abandonment, then you feel, and then what? Because I don't want to lose everything I hold on to.
Yeah.
And I know it's a good thing to lose everything we're holding on to, but it's a good thing, but it doesn't feel nice at least at the beginning. So it's like, because you realize that if you follow that way, then then you cannot step back, because you cannot stop seeing what you have already had a glimpse of.
It's
scary.
So it is scary. And while you were talking, I just thought of another point I might make as well, that in a way we can, the more we practice the Dharma formally, for want of a better word, like the precepts and Dharma study and so on, the more we can trust ourselves to abandon ourselves. It's almost like, because we've got that, if we've got that quite steady in ourselves, we've got our practice of the precepts and we've studied enough to know the difference between right view and wrong view, then we can afford to abandon ourselves more and be more sure that we won't fall into something that's unskillful or not the Dharma. And yes, it won't be safe, you know. And that's exactly what the Dakini represents. So I'm going to say a little bit more about these other aspects, so that we don't run out of time. I'm going to say a little bit about that she's female. Yeah. So there's Bhante talks about there being, well, in a way, three levels to the Dakini being in female form. And we protect the concern with the middle level, but I'll tell you what the other two are. So in the first level, we've got the historical Buddha. The figure on the shrine of the Buddha represents both the historical Buddha, who was male, biologically as it were, but also this figure represents the Buddha principle, the principle of enlightenment. So there's no reason at all why the enlightenment principle should be represented as male rather than female, basically. It can equally be represented as female. So the Dakini simply, on the sort of more simple level, simply is a female Buddha, yeah? So simply, yeah, represents a Buddha who happens to be female. So that's the most simple level. Also, the Dakini, this is the third thing, I won't tell you about the middle thing last. So the Dakini also represents the esoteric form of the Sangha refuge. So interesting enough, you've got that colour red again of the three jewels, the Sangha refuge. And it's the esoteric form. It's what, how I think of this often is, you know, when you're having maybe a really good conversation one-to-one, or maybe you're on retreat with a group of people, and something happens, like a spark seems to be set alight, and something happens that's more than the sum of the parts. Yeah, if you to try and reduce it, say, on a retreat to the individual people or the individual things, you couldn't do it. You couldn't kind of reduce that spark to the individuals. Or it could be, as I say, in a one-to-one conversation where something happens that just, yeah, something comes alive, something comes into being that wasn't there before. It's inspiring. So that's the esoteric Sangha refuge. That's the Dakini. That spark, that's how I see that, is the Dakini. But the way we're talking about, particularly, I want to talk about the Dakini tonight, is as an embodiment of our own energies upsurging. So all the most passionate side of our nature, all our most powerful emotions, including our so-called negative emotions, like anger, jealousy, and so on. Yeah, so all our powerful emotions, yeah, which are, because they're all potentially, we need all that energy. What we need to do is access it and then turn it in the direction of our Dharma life. It's like we have to direct, even teach that energy to serve the Dharma. And of course, there's going to be loads of different ways of doing that. And it'll be different things at different times. And again, in talking about this, in another section of the chapter, Bhante once again, he's obviously very keen on this point, emphasises that we have to free up our energy. And here's what he says here. He says, if we don't have a sense of being surrounded by our energies, then we won't be able to practice the Dharma fully. And he says that most of us don't have that sense, except perhaps in dreams. So I thought that was interesting. He says most of us don't have a sense of that except perhaps in dreams. And he says that it's probably for most of us all our energies are hiding in the cellar, metaphorically, and have to be cajoled out. So what do you make of that? He says that most of us don't have a sense of being surrounded by our energies except perhaps in dreams. Does that resonate for people? Yes, Shan.
Well, it doesn't resonate for me.
Doesn't know.
I sort of feel, I don't know, maybe I just don't know what my energies are.
Okay.
I feel like I don't know what they are and
okay.
What I want to do. And
okay, so you have a, yeah, so you have a sense of, you have a sense that you are surrounded by your energies. Okay, well, great. What about this dream thing? Does anyone ever get surprised or shocked by what they do or encounter in their dreams?
Very.
Yeah. Yeah, me too, actually. I get very, very angry.
Much more positive and much more negative.
Much more positive and much, yeah. That's it, yeah.
Ordinary life.
Yeah. So that's interesting, both more positive and more negative. So I think this is what Sarah Raj is getting. I said, I must confess, mine are often more negative. I wish I had the more positive. I often have very violent dreams where I'm the perpetrator of being very violent. And I was talking to Subhuti, one of our teachers who visits here, about these dreams. And he said that he thought that I had these dreams because I didn't yet have my aggression within my control. And he was really emphasising that the energy of that aggression was very, very positive. But he said, you have to have that more. Well, the sense I got, I have to be able to wield that more. It's not in my control yet, so it's frightening to me, those dreams. I hate waking up for them. But I hate the first few seconds, and I think, oh, it's only a dream, thank goodness. But I think I'll continue. My sense was that he thought, and I think this is true, that until I can wield that aggressive energy skillfully, that I'll continue to have those dreams. Yeah, and I think that's what Sangharakshita means here, that we can have access, some of us anyway, to more, both more positive and more negative. But as I say, I'm waiting for the day of the more positive in my case than in life in general. I remembered a dream when I was reading this. I remembered a dream of a friend of mine. And it's funny to remember someone else's dream, but I've never forgotten this. She said she dreamt she was down in a dungeon, and it was like a labyrinth, and she was being chased by these really evil baddies. And the thing that she said that really struck me, she said, and the baddies knew the way, you know. And I thought that was a very, very potent image, that the baddies knew the way around this labyrinth. She didn't know the way, but the baddies knew the way. And I couldn't help thinking that somehow that this was a teaching for her, that the so-called baddies in her experience, they knew the way, while she didn't know the way. And again, I think that's the kind of thing that Bhante's getting at, that we can often have more powerful energies in our dreams than in our waking life. But it's all us, and if we were really surrounded by our energies, we wouldn't ever be sort of shocked or surprised with it. And even our dream life would be integrated, and it would just we'd be wielding all that energy. Yeah, we'd be surrounded by it and wielding it.
Can you explain a bit more of what you mean by surrounded by?
Well, I think that we've got access to it. It's not hidden from us.
Right.
I think that's what he means. It's interesting he's using that word surrounded. It made me think of the figure of the Dakini being surrounded by flames, but I think that's what he means. We've got access to it. It's
right.
Not down in the cellar.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you mean owning up to them? As if not somebody triggers me, it's my act. It's more that I am angry rather than somebody made me angry.
Well, I think that could be a step. I think owning up to it would be a step. I think face it, just really thinking this is me, that would definitely be a step to this. Well, I keep using this word wielding it, that it's not in control of us, that we are wielding it. While it's still down in the cellar and only appears in our dreams, as it were, or takes us by surprise, that can happen in waking life. Sometimes I get a flare of rage that takes me by surprise and I feel it's controlling me rather than I'm wielding it. And I think if I was surrounded by it, I'd just be really at ease with those energies and I'd be the sort of master of them, able to use them and direct them. I wouldn't be taken by surprise by them. I just know them and, be sort of friends with them in a way. All these things like fear, anger, passion, lust, jealousy, they would be within our power, yeah. Rather than us being in their power, which it can often feel like, I know for me. So, this, it's interesting that this is all drawn out from her, all this energy. I was thinking, why is this drawn out particularly from her being female? But I was thinking the closest thing maybe we've got in more Western culture maybe is something like the muse, who's often female. It's the energy which eventually is inspiration. So all these energies would be transformed to be inspirational forces, yeah? And the Dakini, they're all transformed to be inspirational forces. So, okay, so the Dakini is naked. So what do you think that symbolises? The nakedness.
Truthfulness.
Ah, truthfulness. So why do you say that, Helen?
Well, it's not covered, it's not dressed up or anything, it's just what it is.
Yeah, truthfulness. I think that's it, yeah. And it's a deep truthfulness. It's the truthfulness of nothing to hide, yeah? So well, we talk about the naked truth, don't we? There's nothing to hide, yeah?
It's also like power, because it's what she is, what it is, that's powerful, but what that's what she is. I don't know if I'm explaining
myself.
That's powerful, it's just...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, for me, that ties in with what you're saying. It was that sense of nothing to hide. And it's interesting, actually. I mean, this is made a lot of in Tantric Buddhism, this kind of, this sort of nakedness, directness. So you often will have the figures naked or nearly naked. And interesting enough, when in the book, Bhante talks about a conversation he once had with Allen Ginsberg. There's quite a famous incident, isn't there, when Allen Ginsberg, who was a poet in America and also a Buddhist, and apparently on the stage once, he was giving a talk, I think, or reciting his poetry, and he was talking about the naked truth. And somebody from the audience said, "Well, what do you mean naked?" And Allen Ginsberg just said, "I mean naked," and proceeded just to take his clothes off and didn't say anything more. And that was the teaching. And it's interesting that Bhante picked that example, because I also, whenever I think of the naked truth, I think of Allen Ginsberg for a different reason. I remember seeing him in an interview once with somebody, I can't remember, but I remember I just switched on the TV by accident. I wrote about this in my book, actually. I accidentally switched on the TV, saw this grey-haired figure being interviewed by Jeremy Isaacs, it was. I didn't know who he was, but he was being asked all sorts by the interviewer, really personal questions, all about his life, about sort of everything. And all I saw was a man who was answering these questions completely openly. And I looked at that man, who turned out to be Allen Ginsberg, and I thought, that man has got nothing to fear. That interviewer has got no hold over this man, because there's nothing that he doesn't want to answer. You can see the interviewer trying to trick him out, but it couldn't be done, because he couldn't be tricked, or he couldn't be... he couldn't be tripped up by the interviewer, because he had nothing to hide. It was brilliant, actually. It was such an inspiration of, if you do tell the truth, if you're completely truthful and prepared to be naked, nobody can ever have any power over you, because there's nothing they can sort of get you on. I love that, actually. I was interested that Bhante picked Allen Ginsberg as the example of nakedness, because I too had that in my mind for a slightly different reason. Interesting enough, just as an aside, when Sangharakshita was asked which living Buddhist he most admired, he said Allen Ginsberg, while Allen Ginsberg was still living, obviously. Yeah, and I think it was for this quality of this naked honesty, actually. He could have said the Dalai Lama, but he said Allen Ginsberg. So the Dakini is naked. Also, now it doesn't show this in this picture, but I'll just tell you. So the Dakini is wearing a garland of human skulls, and each skull represents a dead body. One way of interpreting this garland of skulls, Sangharakshita says, is you can see that it represents the whole cycle of our previous lives. Yeah, so that could be literal lives, if we'd kind of subscribe to the notion of rebirth, but it could be our sort of previous lives moment to moment. I mean, we're always recreating ourselves every moment, usually in the same old habitual way, aren't we? Well, I certainly know I am. I'm doing the same old thing and re-becoming the same old person. So the fact that the Dakini is wearing skulls, you could say, is representing that she's breaking through that cycle. Yeah? That's something that they've now died, all those previous lives. As I say, whether literal previous lives or if we think of our just moment to moment rebirths in, well, in the same old way, actually. So, so what Bhante says about that, he says there's a powerful, almost volcanic upsurge of energy bursting through all previous psychological conditionings, yeah? Through the sort of the vicious circle of self-created and self-induced problems, through which most of us live nearly all the time. I mean, I certainly know I do. I can just see myself more and more. It's almost like you see that the more and more you practice, don't you? How you do these same habits over and over again and just end up in the same place. You think, oh God, like here I am again. How did I get here? You know, so the darkening is breaking through that completely and leaves them just hanging there, dead, this necklace of skulls, dead. Yeah? So she's naked, she's got a garland of skulls. And then she's holding the skull cup, as correctly guessed, yeah? The skull cup, which is a cup made out of a skull and filled with blood, yeah? And she's drinking from that. And what this represents is, well, the skull cup represents reality. It represents spiritual death, yeah? And the blood represents the great bliss that arises in the tantric practitioner when he or she plunges into the void, meets spiritual death, and experiences reality.
Why does the skull represent spiritual death?
Well, I guess it's just that because it's made out of bone, which represents death, yeah. So, yeah.
I don't understand what the blood represents.
What the?
I don't quite understand what the blood represents.
What the? The blood. Ah, the blood! The blood. The blood's meant to represent the bliss.
Bliss.
Of when you meet death, you drink. When you, like, usually we're held back by fear, but if we plunge in and don't kind of succumb to the fear, then the blood's meant to represent the life that follows, yeah, so the bliss.
So we drink it in or something?
Yeah, that we drink. So it's a bit like, how I'm seeing it, it's a bit like, I don't know what happened when I asked you, people that we asked you to talk about something you were afraid of, but that you did anyway, and what you experienced. Did anyone experience anything that might be akin to, if not bliss, something that might be? What did people experience when they did? What was the inner experience of doing something you were frightened of?
Real happiness.
Don't quite see it as blood, though.
Well, it's not literal blood. I mean, but I suppose blood is life, isn't it?
Yeah, circulating as well.
Certain circulars.
Yeah,
something circulars, yeah. I mean, I guess these, because they're symbols, it's worth exploring them and not sort of dismissing them in the first instance. At the same time, it's not a literal, it's not literal, so mom might, after it's spoken, we might think, oh, that doesn't really work for me. You know, it doesn't matter, but we're trying to, this is, but we could think of, something like circulating had a resonance. Blood, life.
I mean, for me, it's more that it's completely transgressive. It's so outrageous.
Yeah.
It's such an outrageous thing.
To drink blood. Yeah.
And that is a symbol for enlightenment.
Yeah.
It's so outrageous. It's not conventionally pious.
Yeah.
And that feels very exciting.
Yeah.
Because
but people do drink blood. I mean, people do eat blood sausages and so on.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't want that. That's not what I mean at all.
Yeah, it's more, I mean, it probably is human blood, isn't it? So it's more, I think it is that sort of shock factor, yeah.
Because I think the blood has its dual symbol, because it's the life, but also we are afraid of it, because it's what is spilled when
yeah,
there's violence.
Yeah.
So when if she's drinking the blood, or we are, when we face our fear or grief or rage, it's... We are taking what we most fear, and if you are fed with it, it's also life. It's so there's no bad or wrong, or it's just it's like going into the underworld, really, like all myths. You go into the underworld to what is really like hell.
Yeah.
And you take it and make it
yours
and
you're fine.
Yeah. So I think that's...
Yes, and I think that leads on. I think that thing you said about we're taking what we most fear and sort of and drinking it leads on kind of quite neatly to the other bit of what I'm supposed to be talking about tonight in the last 5 minutes, which is the association of the Dakinis with the cremation grounds, yeah? So Dakinis are very associated with cremation grounds. That's where Dakinis sing and dance. So I'm just going to tell you about these, and we might even do another week on it at some point, because we haven't got loads of time to talk about it. But the cremation ground, there's a cremation ground, it's a charnel ground, it's somewhere like terrifying and not pretty. Yeah, there's decayed bodies and everything all around. So, and that's where the Dakinis dance. Yeah, so they don't go to some beautiful garden full of flowers and dance and sing there. They go to the cremation ground. And what the cremation ground represents is the crucial situation deliberately sought out. Yeah. So the thing we most fear, and it represents actually going towards the thing we most fear, yeah. And as a result, our energy's been stirred into motion, and I think we can see this even on a quite a sort of simple psychological way, that we're often more capable than we thought we were. I mean, you might notice this even on quite everyday levels as well as bigger levels, that often, I mean, I experience this quite a lot. I think, I'll never be able to do such and such a thing. And then in the doing of it, you realise, I have done it, and I'm still alive. And there's an excitement in that, a sort of liberation and you just feel much more potent. Whereas if I went with my first instinct, there's a sort of, I also know what it's like to not do something because of fear, for example, but it's such a sort of diminishing feeling, that, isn't it? Whereas if you do it, sometimes people give you a little nudge, don't they? They say, go on, do it. You know, and actually you realise, in the doing of it, you realise you were capable of much, much more. So there's a strong encouragement from the Dakini to just to plunge in, to plunge into what we're calling crucial situations, and in a way invoking the Dakinis. If this figure speaks, we can call on the Dakinis to help us in that situation, or even we can, maybe we don't even need to call on them, we can start to place more and more confidence that the Dakinis will arise, that those energies will upsurge. Yeah? So we'll need courage to do that. You need the initial courage to do it, and then you something that you didn't even know was in you comes up and you can do it, yeah? And this is what there's very much the encouragement of with the Dakini, to take the plunge into these cremation grounds. It's a very, very potent way of overcoming fear, yeah? It's making a point of doing the very thing that you're afraid of. Just as the tantric practitioners would go not just to the cremation ground, but go there in night, you know, when there's no moon or no light, yeah? And go alone. And it's good, isn't it, just to emphasise that quality of fearlessness as a virtue, because I think sometimes in the spiritual life it's not emphasised. Sometimes the more qualities like compassion and gentleness and taking care of ourselves and so on can be emphasised. But there has to be fearlessness as well. If we want to become enlightened, we'll have to develop fearlessness. We'll have to have courage, because it's not going to be, like you were saying, it's not going to be safe or even pleasant. Yeah, so we're going to have to develop fearlessness. So I wanted to say a whole lot more about the cremation ground and what might constitute a cremation ground, but I think I'm going to save that for another week to do that, because there's a whole lot more to be said about that. But maybe I'll just leave you with that, and maybe leave you to think about, well, what might be cremation grounds for you? I mean, they can be such small things, can't they? Or so seeming small things. Actually, they're not small when they may seem small from the outside. It could be as simple, as I was saying earlier, as having a conversation with someone that you're afraid to have. It could be going on your first retreat. It could be speaking in public. It could be, you know, deciding that, you know, to leave a job. It could be deciding to leave a relationship or start a relationship. You know, there are many, many things that we hold ourselves back because of fear. So the encouragement is to look for where we do that, and especially where we hold ourselves back in our Dharma lives, yeah? And the encouragement is to, well, take the plunge and trust that the Dakinis will arise, and that experience in itself, it gives us more confidence then. It gives us, we start to learn that we were capable of far more than we thought we were. That in itself starts to free up those energies. I've experienced that loads of times in my life. It's a sort of path of just doing it. Yeah, it's a path of just doing it, rather than holding back. So I think I'll leave you with that. And next week we're exploring another symbol. That must mean it's Diabetra doing it. Oh, the archetypal guru. Right, what could be better? Yeah. So that's what we're exploring next week, the archetypal guru. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.